America's banker of last resort? He's not here. He's in China.
What else do we know about this Chinese gentleman?
Nothing much, except his name. Dr. No.
Dr. No is from a James Bond flick. Today there is a real Chinese lawyer who is in charge of hundreds of billions of U.S. debt. When the U.S. says bailout, you might say he's the Treasury's ATM. When Dr. No needs to be Dr. Yes. It's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Monday, December 8th. And John, I need a Dr. Yes in my life. How about you?
The U.S. has a major Dr. Yes.
A major. We're going to have a lot more on that story coming up. We're also going to follow new developments in the automaker's quest for a bailout. And plus, we'll pry open a box from our partners at the BBC. Inside are some very interesting insights into the global economy. Those stories are coming up, but first, these headlines.
Bond foe Dr. No, who we referred to a moment ago, meddled with American rocket launches. Maybe General Motors CEO Rick Wagoner feels a little like a missile is aimed at him.
I think he has to move on.
That's Senator Chris Dodd, who chairs the Senate Banking Committee. He was on Face the Nation on CBS. Lawmakers are working on a deal that could give around $15 billion in loans to automakers, but there will be strings attached, and Dodd's comments mean perhaps the ouster of GM's CEO.
Retired Army General Eric Shinseki is the newest nominee to the Obama cabinet. The president-elect picked the former Army Chief of Staff as Veterans Affairs Secretary. Here's Shinseki.
A word to my fellow veterans. If confirmed, I will work each and every day to ensure that we are serving you as well as you have served us.
Perhaps the last time you heard his voice was in 2003 when he told Congress it would take hundreds of thousands of American troops to stabilize post-invasion Iraq. That didn't sit well with then-Defense Secretary Don Rumsfeld. The comments effectively ended Shinseki's active duty career. We'll talk about why Shinseki's appointment is so important in just a moment. More than a dozen militants are under arrest in Pakistan on suspicion of helping the Mumbai attackers. Pakistani forces raided a camp used by the militant group Lashkar-e-Taiba. Many blame that group for the shootings. There are reports this morning that one of the militants captured was the man India says masterminded the attacks.
That's what it sounded like on Greek streets today. And over the weekend, a fatal police shooting of a 15-year-old boy in Athens triggered widespread protests. Some turned violent as rioters smashed windows and torched dozens of cars and banks. A Greek cop involved with the shooting faces a murder charge.
Gas is now at its lowest price in nearly 5 years. This according to a new national survey. Right now, the average price of regular is $1.75 a gallon.
Wall Street's happy about that. It's poised to open very, very positive. The Dow gained 3% on Friday, and the S&P was up more than 3.5% to begin trading today at 876.
Does it matter, John, where your stuff, food, or clothes, where it comes from?
I hate buying apples from New Zealand in fall in New York, where we have lots of apples in season.
We're looking at how our food and other products travels around the world before coming to our home. We want to hear from you. Do you have a preference? Do you know where your stuff comes from?
South America for fruit, Mexico for fruit. Will you only buy cars made in America? I guess that's a rhetorical question since the auto industry isn't doing so well.
Anyhow, 877-8 my take.
Thank you.
Or my take at thetakeaway.org.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Star Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org. And by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
The auto industry is the backbone of American manufacturing. It is a huge employer across many states. Millions of people, directly or indirectly, are reliant on that industry. And so I don't think it's an option to simply allow it to collapse.
That was President-elect Barack Obama. He wants to create 2.5 million jobs in his first term, but he doesn't want to do it by losing 2 million if the auto industry goes down. The serious question of what to do with the U.S. auto industry is on the minds of policymakers from the transition team to Capitol Hill, which is putting up some tough resistance to bailing out the big three. Some observers say that failing to bail out the auto industry would have catastrophic consequences at all levels of the U.S. labor market. Joining us is Stephen Greenhouse, labor and workplace correspondent for The New York Times. Stephen, thanks for being with us.
Nice to be here, John.
Now, Stephen, you write that perhaps there are lessons from as unlikely a place as the failure of the investment bank Lehman Brothers in looking as to what the unintended consequences of a failure of the big three automakers might be.
Yes. In the piece I have today, John, I quote several economists saying that when the Treasury Department, when the Bush administration let the Lehman Brothers go under and collapse, go into bankruptcy, they thought it would be a minor matter. They never thought it was going to have the huge ripple effects that it did. And these economists say, the folks in Congress who say we should just not provide a bailout, we should just let Detroit take care of its own business and perhaps collapse, they're saying that the ramifications, the ripple effect of that could be much, much larger, could be even catastrophic.
Well, let's get into the details of that. I mean, I remember at the time Lehman Brothers was being allowed to fail, according to sourced and unsourced comments coming out of the Treasury Department, because we wanted to signal to the financial sector that certain things could fail, that everybody wasn't going to get a bailout, and that some companies would be allowed to fail if they were in such bad shape. The effect was to terrify all of the banks into jumping into the Treasury, and now all of them are holding companies. There are virtually no more investment banks. And so the suspicion would be if you let the big three fail, you're going to have all of the entire manufacturing companies in the United States and service companies and everything else that's in trouble, all the retailers running to Washington. Is that sort of how it works?
There's that fear partly. There are several fears going on, John. One is, right now, 2 weeks ago, the big three of Detroit were asking for $25 billion. Then, whoops, this week they were suddenly asking for $34 billion. And I think some folks in Congress fear that, deep down, they're going to have to end up shelling out $100 billion, $125 billion to really save Detroit. So that's one thing they're worried. And people talk about acute bailout fatigue. Folks in Congress are worried, what industry will come to us next? If we help the big three automakers, will we be helping machinery factories or steel mills or who knows what other industries will be coming.
A lot of people who have been laid off in this environment have found themselves vulnerable because they're so highly paid that they start peeling off the incomes from the top, as opposed to a recession in the 70s where it was sort of last in, first out. Seniority was the dynamic. Is it possible that the effect of whatever happens to the auto industry is going to illustrate that union jobs in the United States are more vulnerable than ever before?
Yes or no. GM, Chrysler are in dire condition. They've made many, 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 many strategic mistakes over the years, producing gas guzzlers, Hummers. And that's, I think, the main problem they face. They also have somewhat uncompetitive labor costs. And you take that plus the economic crisis we're facing and the banks are not making money available for people to buy cars, and you take that all together, and we see this huge crisis in Detroit. And one factor that could help Detroit become more competitive and stay on its feet would be to help rein in the labor costs and their huge costs for the hundreds of thousands of auto retirees also that are helping make the car companies uncompetitive. But I think in other industries, like airlines, union wages are still standing up pretty well. In ways, Detroit is a very, very unusual situation.
Finally, Stephen, there's a lot of talk, open talk on Capitol Hill and even among individuals who are specifically involved with financial bailouts of reshuffling the management of these auto companies. Is there a lack of consistency in how willing the companies are or Washington is to, get rid of Rick Wagoner of GM and maybe not mess with the management at AIG or Merrill Lynch or some of the other
group?
Yeah, there you go.
That's a very astute question, John. Yes. Well, I've often wondered as well, why are they not pushing out the leadership of some of the big banks, insurance companies that have been bailed out? But, you know, it's clear that for many years the automakers have been making big, big mistakes, and you know, General Motors most of all. And I think, you know, people can rationally say that Rick Wagoner has not done a great job. And I think there's also an effort to scapegoat and say, look, we're not going to give GM tens of billions of dollars unless we put a change agent. We want change right. We can believe in at General Motors.
Well, you got to sacrifice some lambs to get $34 billion out of the Treasury if you're talking to Congress, Stephen Greenhouse. That seems to be the takeaway this morning. Thanks so much for joining us.
Nice to be here, John. Thanks.
Stephen Greenhouse is labor and workplace correspondent for The New York Times.
And now we're going to take a look at the Army general that President-elect Barack Obama has picked to head the Department of Veterans Affairs. General Shinseki was wounded serving two combat tours in Vietnam. He is the first Asian four-star general, but perhaps he's best known for burning bridges with the Bush administration by questioning the Pentagon's Iraq war strategy. Connie Lawn joins us now. She's from the BBC. Welcome, Connie.
Hello. Glad to talk to you.
Certainly a vindication of sorts for Shinseki.
Well, it is, and it's another in a string of absolutely brilliant appointments that Barack Obama has made. Even the Republicans, even very conservative Republicans, have been overwhelmed by how even moderate to the right many of his choices have been. But in the case of this general, for him to have gotten it before the Congress and warning that the strategy of the Iraqi war was wrong, in fact, that the war was wrong, and that if you were going to win the war, you had to have at least another 100,000 troops. And, of course, to the Bush administration, Donald Rumsfeld especially, were furious and literally forced this brilliant four-star general out of the Army. I'm surrounded by about 800 veterans this week, and so they were all talking about the appointment. They feel that they'll finally get some help because a man like this is going to be the head of the Veterans Administration. And they call him a soldier's soldier, and they feel very good about him.
And, Connie, why do you think this job, as opposed to, say, something at the Department of Defense or in national security?
Well, you know, it depends on what kind of a job he does. Veterans Affairs is very, very important. The veterans have gotten short shrift. There's so many wounded veterans in this country and, of course, the United Kingdom, all around the world, but mostly in the U.S. and the U.K., and veterans suffering severe emotional problems in addition to the physical problems. They need somebody good at the Veterans Administration, which has been a hugely troubled administration. If this general does a good job, maybe in a year from now he could be promoted to Secretary of Defense, because Robert Gates, who stays as Defense Secretary, who's there now and will stay after the new administration, might not be there forever. He might not be there more than a year or so.
You describe the general as brilliant. What do you think he's going to specifically bring to this job other than being able to identify with all of the soldiers who go through the Veterans Administration?
Well, that's precisely it. He will bring sympathy and he will bring a determination to get better military care and medical care for them, and especially pay attention to those with mental problems. This post-traumatic stress disorder, PTSD, is really widespread. In fact, almost every soldier, anybody who's ever been in a war, suffers from mental problems or physical problems to some extent, and he's really got to get a grip on it. There's so much red tape. The Veterans Administration is one of the most impossible agencies to deal with. And to have a good man at the helm or a good women at the helm do would be very important. So he's going to do it. He doesn't take no from anybody. He's not afraid of anybody.
Mm-hmm.
And it was so ironic. It was such beautiful symbolism on the President-elect Obama's part to name him on Pearl Harbor Day, and the fact that he's Hawaiian, as is Barack Obama, but he's also part Japanese-American, to head the Veterans Administration. And to be named on Pearl Harbor Day is just extraordinary symbolism.
And you're at a conference. Could you just quickly describe what it is? And did people break out in cheers? Or is this overwhelming good feeling about having General Shinseki leading the administration?
Very good feeling. As I talk to them individually, I'm here with 800 wounded warriors. This is the 21st ski spectacular at Breckenridge, Colorado, and these men and women, they're out there skiing. Some of them have just lost limbs in Iraq and Afghanistan as recently as 6 months ago, and they're out here on the slopes, and it's quite a beautiful thing to see.
That's the BBC's Connie Lawn speaking to us about General Shinseki's appointment to head the Department of Veterans Affairs.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, asking what is responsibility in this day and age? Everybody has their own opinion, discussions, and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
I didn't hear a lot of bellicose talk between by Indian leaders or with Pakistani leaders. This is a relationship between India and Pakistan that has improved, and they're trying to build on that. But India expects Pakistan to act, and so does the United States.
That's Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice yesterday making the rounds on the Sunday talk shows after returning from her trip to India and Pakistan. It is a complicated situation, to say the least. Pramit Chaudhary, senior editor of the Hindustan Times and an Asia Society International Council member, joins us now for more. Welcome.
Thank you.
So was the secretary's trip successful?
Well, it's given time. It's basically demanded, or she has put pressure on Pakistan to pay a price for at least tolerating the Lashkar-e-Toiba, the militant group that is blamed for the attack in the Mumbai hotels. And the question now is whether Pakistan will pay it and whether it will be enough, because it's not completely certain what will be acceptable to India.
And whether or not the response will be credible to India, because we're reading a lot about how India is under growing pressure to retaliate in some way. How would you measure that pressure?
It's considerable. During the attacks, five Indian states actually went to the elections. They actually held their elections during the terrorist attacks. And it's widely expected the results, which will probably come out in the next few days, will indicate a very strong electoral reaction against Prime Minister Manmohan Singh for his perceived incompetence in handling the terrorist attack. And in any case, his party, India has to go for general election sometime before April. So if there is a very strong electoral response, his party now will face probably certain defeat in the elections that are coming up. So obviously the need to have a strong response will now be one of the electoral considerations over the next few months.
And what position do you think that Pakistan is really in to crack down?
Well, that's part of the key problem. There is nobody really in charge in Pakistan right now. We have a president, Zardari, who does not control the military and is daggers drawn with the leader of the opposition. The prime minister is equally powerless. And the military is essentially running its own independent structure. And then amidst all this, you have these Islamic militant groups who also function virtually as a state within the state.
Well, Mr. Chaudhary, you're arguing there for a scenario which disturbingly sounds a lot like Israel / Gaza, where in a sense, because there is no perceived control within the Palestinian community, Israel is motivated to take unilateral actions to restrict the border, to crack down on perhaps the Islamic community inside India. That sort of scenario where you take internal matters and matters related to your border to try to enforce security against a terrorist group that appears to be operating freely inside Pakistan, that would be a very disturbing result.
Well, there's a number of key differences. One, Pakistan is still a much larger entity than the Palestinian nation, and it has nuclear weapons. The army is still by far the most integrated, coherent, and powerful force within the Pakistan system. And if it wishes, it is in a position to enforce almost anything that it wants. So a lot of what happens essentially in all of this is really designed to put pressure on the military in Pakistan to carry out actions.
Can India have direct relations with the army without compromising the civilian leadership?
No, it can't. It cannot have direct diplomatic relations. But India makes it very clear through a number of back channels that it has with Pakistan and maintains with Pakistan, that we recognize that Zardari is not the man who is in charge here, and General Kiani, who is the Army Chief of Staff, mm-hmm. is. So we expect him to take action. And that's one of the reasons why the military strikes option is now being debated in India, because that is a direct attack and essentially a humiliation for the Pakistan military more than it is for anybody else.
So given all of these dynamics, what can Pakistan do that the U.S. will and India will accept as truly making efforts as they've promised?
It's a good question. We don't fully know. Right now, they've already begun a crackdown on Lashkar camps. And I think a lot of this will now depend on evidence that Pakistan is taking action, combined with a recognition of how weak the Pakistani system is right now to actually do anything, and combined with an issue of how much the Indian public is prepared to accept that this is sufficient. And I think this is going to be a sort of a shifting landscape, or mm-hmm. a shifting set of indices over the next few months, as the Pakistani, Indian, and the U.S. governments try to make a judgment as to what exactly will be acceptable to the electorate. Prime Minister Manmohan Singh may decide that he may just sacrifice his political career.
Well, you certainly describe a combustible situation. We appreciate your thoughts this morning.
Thank you.
That's Pramit Chowdhury, a senior editor at the Hindustan Times and an Asia Society International Council member, and he was coming to us from Washington, D.C. And now we turn to Femi Okeh with the headlines.
And the time is just coming up to 28 minutes past the hour. Gas is at its lowest price in nearly 5 years. A new national survey says that right now, the average price of regular is $1.75 a gallon. Last week, the price of gas dropped 25%. That's the biggest decline in a week since 1991. The Senate will take another look at a package for automakers this morning. Congressional aides say that an auto industry package may include high-level oversight and mandatory restructuring. They say that Congress may include provisions to withdraw money from the failing industry if the companies fail to meet expectations. The European Union will start patrolling the coast of Somalia today, and they are trying to counter attacks from pirates with navy ships and helicopters. Recently, Somali pirates have started using more powerful weapons to hijack larger ships. Archbishop Desmond Tutu says that Zimbabwe's President Robert Mugabe must step down or face charges at The Hague. Zimbabwe now faces the country's most deadly cholera outbreak. Some 600 people have died. The Archbishop says that President Mugabe should be removed by force if necessary. And finally, the last story of a newscast is generally called a kicker, which is a particularly appropriate way to update you on the mystery of the missing feet. Now, in the last few months, several feet have washed ashore along Canada's west coast. A recent female right foot found last month has been matched to a left foot discovered in May. Investigators have made another match in five of the other feet that have been found, and they believe that the foot belonged to a man yet to be identified. And apparently feet actually stay a long while and they don't decompose because they generally have shoes or trainers or something on which saves them from decomposing. You're sighing, John. Just added information.
For my breakfast. Yeah, thank you very much, Femi.
You're welcome.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org, and by the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs around the world. Uncommon heroes dedicated to the common good. Learn more at skoll.org.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual Insurance, offering home, auto, and life insurance products to individuals and families who put a premium on doing the right thing. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning. If we're fortunate, we have plenty of food to eat, we have clothes on our backs, and all of those things, well, they come from somewhere. Do you know where?
Hi, this is Tom from Bloomfield. I actually work in the container industry. You know, I think it's crazy that stuff that we can grow here, like, you know, especially the food that we're buying it from overseas just to save some multinational corporation a few dollars. But there's certain things that we do have to import. But food especially, people should buy them locally. It's just crazy to buy it from overseas.
Speaking of containers, the industry that he works in, those are usually where our things, our food, our clothes, where they come in when they're coming from other countries. Do you pay attention to that? Give us a call, 877-8-MY-TAKE or MyTAKE at thetakeaway.org for your thoughts on this. And we're speaking of it because our partners at the BBC have put together a container, a special container that's been traveling the world. And we spoke with the BBC's Jeremy Hillman for more on this sociological adventure and how he got the idea.
Well, funnily enough, I got the idea from a book called The Box, which was written by a very lovely New York-based author called Mark Levinson, which told the story of the global container industry and how the humble shipping container was more important for the growth of the global economy and world trade than the microchip. And it was something I hadn't really thought about before. I'd seen them on the freeways and I'd seen them out and about. But to think of the importance of these shipping containers and what they've done for the global economy was fascinating.
And they're so low-tech, just a simple old container, been around a long time. Where has your container been and what has it picked up?
Well, we started the project in September. So far, it started off in the UK and we launched it down in Southampton in the south coast of the UK. It then went up to Scotland and took a huge shipment of Scotch whiskey over to Shanghai. We're now being drunk in the bars of Shanghai, I'm sure. And from there, it went to Japan. And from Japan, it arrived on the west coast of your country, of the USA, just a week or so ago. And we've been telling the story of its arrival there, loaded with tape measures and other bits and pieces.
From where? Tape measures from where?
Tape measures that were constructed in the factories in Shanghai.
So the idea is
the workshop of the world.
So the idea is to load up stuff from one location and take it to another location and get indigenous stuff from that location and to tell the story of where stuff comes from and how it gets around.
To go back to the beginning, this is a real working box. We wanted to find a way to tell the story of the global economy, of internationalization, in a real tangible way that people could see and they could feel and they could understand. So we're not controlling what goes in this container. It's really traveling the world. It's going wherever it goes. And we've bolted on satellite transmitter to it so that our people can track it online. They can see exactly where the container is at any time of the day or night, what's in this container. And what we're trying to do as a broadcaster is tell the stories behind the world trade. Who are the guys making the stuff that's going in this
container?
Tell
us
how are
story.
They living?
Tell
who are the guys
story,
consuming
Jeremy.
Stuff coming out?
Tell us a story about one of the things in the box.
Well, I mean, I tell you what was fascinating. World trade is, it's a very hard to understand concept, you know, balance of payments, what does that mean? Exchange rates, what impact do they have on the way we live our lives? And actually what we found was there's an amazing success story. We're living in very gloomy times right now, but Scotch whiskey makers up in Greenock in Scotland, and they're making Chivas Regal whiskey. They're having a great time because they're exporting tons of this stuff to the new middle classes in China because the UK pound sterling is very weak at the moment. And therefore, suddenly, British exports are looking pretty good for our international buyers.
Well, so, the Chinese are losing so much money on the stock market, they want to drink scotch
heavily.
They
need to drink to keep themselves cheerful.
Yeah, I think that's the deal. You know, Jeremy, you're not controlling what goes in this box, so
right.
You're going to be in trouble if a lot of nuclear warheads or SARS
virus
gets in
there. Yeah, well, I mean, obviously,
the
moment that 100 kilograms of heroin turns up somewhere, I'm in big trouble and I'm probably out of a job.
Who is deciding what goes in and how does the box get directed to its next location?
Well, we're working with a shipping company, a very large one of the world's top 10 shipping companies, NYK, who have been very helpful in working out all the logistics of this project with us. So we didn't buy the box. We've paid a little for the branding of the box. We're obviously paying for some of the satellite tracking and we're paying for the coverage around the stories that we're doing. But NYK, the shipping company, is using this box as one of their real boxes that's traveling the world, and they're booking with their normal suppliers and manufacturers and retailers as they would do normally. And we're in constant contact with them and planning the next stage. So what happens is each time we're a couple of weeks away, they'll say, right, the box is now heading off to XYZ, and we'll make sure we've got a correspondent in place ready to greet it coming in.
Jeremy, any thought about the containers themselves? I mean, often after they've stopped carrying stuff around the world. They have a life as shelter, or I've even heard of them being made into mobile clinics in certain places in Africa.
Well, it's very funny you should say that, and you've obviously very well read on this subject. But our box, we got an offer a month or so ago from a charity that would like to turn our box into a classroom. And NYK, the shipping company, has very kindly agreed to donate the box, and it will go to Africa and become a classroom at the end of the project, which is fantastic because it gives it a lasting legacy.
Jeremy, last question quickly. What have you learned about the relations between and among nations in this journey?
Well, I think what we've been able to do, Adora, is actually, because we didn't launch this product, we didn't know what was going to happen with the global economy. And what's happened has been dramatic and incredibly suspenseful. And we've been able to use the box as a device to really try and understand what's happening in the global economy. One example is that the cost of shipping stuff around the world in the last few weeks has plummeted dramatically. It used to cost about $2,500 to send something from Shanghai back to Europe. That's now a fraction of that cost. And it's just showing that fewer and fewer goods are moving around the world as we go into what looks like being a pretty horrible global slump.
So the box is traveling through the U.S. If people want to get a peek, where's it going to be? Quick.
Well, listen, if any of your listeners want to go to bbc.com/thebox, they'll be able to track it as it travels across the states. I believe it's going to be going through New Mexico, through Texas, Iowa, Illinois. It ends up in New Jersey in, Tremont? I'm not sure of the pronunciation. And it's going to get unloaded there. And then we think the next leg of the journey is going to be taking probably paper from New Jersey down to Brazil.
Paper from New Jersey to Brazil. Jeremy Hillman, the editor of Business and Economics for the BBC and the founder of the Special Box Project. Now we turn to Femi Oke with headlines.
Thank you very much. Just coming up to 20 minutes to the top of the hour. Wall Street is set for an upbeat start this morning. Investors are enthusiastic that President-elect Barack Obama's infrastructure spending package will help boost the economy. It's the biggest such package since the 1950s. Oil prices are above $43 a barrel in Asia. They responded to a statement by OPEC's president. He suggested the group could cut production later this month. President-elect Obama has named former Army Chief of Staff Eric Shinseki as his Secretary of Veterans Affairs. Barack Obama says that retired General Eric Shinseki has the right kind of experience to head the Veterans Affairs Department.
He has always stood on principle because he has always stood with our troops. And he will bring that same sense of duty and commitment to ensuring that we treat our veterans with the care and dignity that they deserve.
Back in 2003, General Shinseki criticized Rumsfeld's plan to invade Iraq. He said they weren't going to send enough troops. And that's a look at some of the big stories making news for you this morning.
Thank you, Femi.
Thanks very much.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
Good morning. I'm Adora Udoji, and this is The Takeaway.
And I'm John Hockenberry. And the history of your breakfast really is more sophisticated than just whether you left the eggs out last night and they've been sitting on the counter all morning. If you're eating your breakfast now, think of the history of what it is that you're eating. And if you happen to be eating a bagel, well, then you'll be thrilled that joining us now is Maria Bolinska, who's the author of The Bagel, The Surprising History of a Modest Bread. And she's also the editor of The World, Current Affairs Radio. Maria, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for inviting me.
There's a lot to get to here. I mean, I'm a lover of bagels, and you found possibly a lineage of bagels that begins in Poland.
That's right. The first mention of the bagel as a Jewish bread is in 1610 in Poland. But my theory is it's connected to a Polish bread called the obwajanek. And the first mention of the obwajanek in Poland, in the same city of Krakow, is 1395.
And what would you have on your obwajanek?
What would you have? Well, you wouldn't have anything, actually, because in those days it was very dense, very hard, much thinner, And you would have, if you were, the first mention in 1395 is in the court records of the Polish queen, and she would have eaten it for Lent.
Huh.
It was a fasting bread. And the bagel itself also, you would probably have just had on its own, or if it were a few hours old, dunked in some tea.
Wow. Well, there's nothing fasting about bagels these days. The modern bagel is made in a way that's interesting. It's boiled and fried. Explain what that does.
Boiled and baked. And in fact, it's always been boiled and baked. This is something I could go on. As you know, people who love bagels love to talk about just how long it should be boiled for, and in what kind of water and so forth. But very quickly, the boiling means that it keeps its shape. It holds the shape, and it won't. If it went into the oven straight away, it would probably rise a lot quicker, and therefore would not be as sort of compact. The other thing it does is it gelatinizes the starch in the crust, so it makes a nice nice glossy crust that you've got on a bagel.
And also the nice softness on the inside.
Indeed.
And it's also why the bagels go stale so quickly, because that is a very, very perishable situation that the boiling and baking makes. Now, my favorite story in your book, and there's a lot of great stories in there, is how lenders decided to take over the breakfast world in America with frozen bagels. How did that happen?
Well, it happened that they introduced freezing because they were actually working very, very hard. They had a bakery in New Haven. They were working very hard every day of the week, but of course the big demand was on the weekend, and then they never had a break, so they thought, all right, well, maybe if we freeze it and then just sort of, you know, defrost and deliver them, it will be, the customers won't notice the difference. Well, at a certain point, the customers, they were delivered unfrosted. They were still frozen. And there was a big hoopla, but actually the customers realized they'd been eating frozen bagels for months and hadn't noticed the difference.
Wow.
What happened was the Lenders brothers realized that actually this was a huge opportunity, that now the bagel, which as you say goes stale so quickly, could be distributed across the country in frozen trucks.
And it changed the world, and indeed my mother, when she discovered Lenders bagels in the freezer case, transformed our breakfast. Have you had your bagel this morning, Maria?
Well, today I haven't had a bagel,
all
I'm
right.
afraid, because I'm very picky about my bagels, as you probably imagine, and I like my bagels from a certain source, and I didn't manage to get to that source
all
over
right.
the weekend.
Maria Belinsky is the author of The Bagel, The Surprising History of a Modest Bread. Thanks so much.
You're welcome.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, featuring stories of responsible acts that happen every day. Stories to read, share, and respond to, available at responsibilityproject.com. Because one responsible act can make an unforgettable difference.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. It's Monday, December 8th. Femi OK has the headlines.
And the time is 12 minutes to the top of the hour. Good morning. A top lawmaker wants the CEO of General Motors out. Senate Banking Committee Chair Chris Dodd says that Rick Wagoner should move on. Congress currently is working on a deal to give the big three automakers a loan package. There'll be strings attached to the money. Dodd's comments are a sign that Wagoner's ouster may be one of them. A group of laid-off workers is making waves and getting support from as high up as President-elect Barack Obama. Employees of a Chicago factory staged a sit-in after the company cut all of their jobs. Workers say they won't leave until they are guaranteed money for severance and unused vacation. The president-elect says the company should keep its commitments to the employees. A dozen militants are under arrest in Pakistan on suspicion of helping the Mumbai attackers. Pakistani forces raided a camp used by the militant group accused of the attack in Mumbai, and many blame that group for the shootings. There are reports this morning that one of the militants captured was the man India calls, the man that India says masterminded the attacks in Mumbai last week. The Taliban is now operating in more than 70% of Afghanistan. That's according to a new report by the International Council on Security and Development. NATO questions the findings. James Apathorai is a NATO spokesman.
in essence, the Taliban is in the south and the east. They have been in the south and the east. They're still in the south and the east. And they don't hold territory anywhere where international forces can go or where Afghan forces can go. So we feel that while it's not exactly at a tipping point of success, it's not nearly as bad.
And the Afghan government has also strongly rejected the think tank's findings. That's a look at some big stories making news this morning.
Thanks, Femi.
There are levers of power and levers of money. And every time the powers that be in Washington, D.C. talk about a new bailout, the levers of money need to be pulled around the world. And some of the biggest levers are in China, which owns the lion's share of American debt, perhaps $2 trillion worth. And in charge of $200 billion of that debt is Gao Xiqing, a Chinese official, lawyer, trained in the United States, who's the subject of a profile by national correspondent for The Atlantic magazine, James Fallows, who spoke with Gao Xiqing about the recession and the power that China suddenly has over the U.S. economic future. James Fallows joins us now from Beijing. Thanks for being with us, James.
My pleasure.
First of all, how did you find Gao Xiqing?
I guess the real answer would be with some difficulty. It's been over the last year that I've been trying to arrange this interview with him because it is quite unusual for Chinese officials, especially of this prominence, to talk on the record with foreign journalists. So he certainly wasn't difficult to notice in China because he's such a prominent person, but it was a long matter of sort of establishing trust that he'd be able to convey his words and he wouldn't create problems either for China or himself or the U.S. by talking on the record.
And he's the president of the China Investment Corporation, which is you know, why he's so important. But being in charge of $200 billion of debt, what is it exactly that he can pull the lever of? I mean, what is it that he controls?
The main thing he does day by day in practical terms is make a lot of China's high visibility investments. For example, last year they took a big stake in Blackstone and lost a lot of money doing that. And that's been hugely controversial within China. People say, oh, my hard-earned RMB, you know, the Chinese money that I've saved from my job as a seamstress, you're now investing it with these New York bankers. And he has taken a similar position with Goldman Sachs. More broadly, when there are discretionary investments by the Chinese government with their surplus, not just buying the T-notes, but deciding where to put money into the stock exchange, where to try to take strategic positions in actual companies. This China Investment Corporation, of which he's the president, is the main actor.
And the investment corporation not only guarantees U.S. liquidity to fund all of these infrastructure projects that are being talked about, including the financial bailout, he's got to answer to the zillions of Chinese savers, and they are a saving culture. And so he's getting it from both ends.
It's a really interesting bind that Mr. Gao is in. I think he's a particularly interesting figure, which is why I was so glad to be able to have him speak directly to English-speaking readers through this article. There's a generation of people like him. He's in his mid-50s who grew up in really hard times in China. He worked on a railroad gang during the Cultural Revolution. He was educated in the U.S. He practiced as a Wall Street lawyer. Now, coming back to China, he's familiar with U.S. culture, of course, familiar with Chinese culture, and trying to walk the tightrope of making positions in the U.S. and foreign markets without seeming too ominous or too much like a Chinese banking overlord when doing that, but also answering to Chinese savers and the Chinese politicians when there have been huge losses for this $200 billion portfolio, as there have been for all of us.
James, how would you describe his demeanor, and why do you think he allowed for an interview now?
His demeanor, I think that if more Chinese officials, number one, were like him, but number two, also expose themselves to the world public, I think there'd be a much different impression of China around the world. He comes across as a very jokey person. He looks like somebody from Silicon Valley. He's, as I say, he's 55, but he has a black crew cut. He wears Silicon Valley type CEO clothes, informal open neck shirts, and he's very direct and humorous. It's often the case when dealing with potentates in China or other Asian countries that you get this very stilted rhetoric, and it's hard to see the actual person beneath there. There's no barrier to the actual person of Gao Xiqing. As to why he did this, I've spent a long time trying to establish a relationship of trust with him, and I think he may have sensed that it was time for people like him who can address the thinking patterns and the concerns and the language of the U.S. public and the world public to do something when the rest of the government was doing so poorly in trying to communicate with the outside world?
Well, so many people, when they talk about the future of the financial bailout in this world financial crisis, claim that the big sort of five-alarm event will be when China begins to unwind its accounts in dollars and unwinds its U.S. investments, maybe diversifying out of the U.S. into some other sorts of investments. When that happens, the value of U.S. financial assets is apparently going to plummet. Do you have any evidence that, first of all, he's aware of that tightrope, and secondly, that they're inclined to use that weapon in some way?
Well, he certainly is 100% or 1 million percent aware
right.
of the situation. And in a short term, he recognizes that it's a kind of suicide pact in the short term. If China started a run on the U.S. dollar or run on U.S. equities, then this $2 trillion of money that China has largely in dollars, that would shrink a lot more dramatically than it has. So in the short term, there is a wedded at the hip situation of the U.S. and China in this regard. In the long term, it's clear that China knows that China and Mr. Gao and others are judging their options. On the one hand, it's important to them for manufacturing terms to keep having a big export market to the U.S., and so they want to maintain the relationship in that way. If they think the U.S. currency is headed for a long-term decline, then that would steer them away. And while I have to say this somewhat carefully, it's clear to me that many people of influence in the Chinese financial system were watching the U.S. election very carefully, and that if the other side had won, I think they would have taken that as a sort of sell American stocks signal that the U.S. would not have been able to deal with its financial situation.
Well, James Fallows, of course, Obama won. And why don't you listen to this economic proposition that you actually quote in the beginning of your article in The Atlantic?
Nothing's more important than us no longer borrowing $700 billion or more from China and sending it to Saudi Arabia.
Any chance, James Fallows, that that's likely to change anytime soon?
Well, the Saudi Arabian part, I'll leave to others who know that better. In terms of the borrowing from China part, it's likely that one effect of the collapse of demand that, as we all know, is going on in the U.S. right now, is the U.S. going to be buying less stuff from China. That's why there being lots of layoffs in Chinese plants. And so the flow of money is being reduced in that gross sense for reasons that are not good for anybody because of the worldwide slowdown. I think the question in the longer term, you know, what Obama was talking about was sort of the hollowing out of the manufacturing base and just shipping it all off for energy supplies. And I think that it's in China's interest and the U.S. too to have a sustainable economic relationship where the U.S. where neither side feels
right.
victimized. So that's to be worked out.
Well, for the time being, we're on the hook. They're on the hook. James Fallows, thanks so much for joining us. National correspondent for The Atlantic magazine. His profile of Gao Xiching appears in the current issue. Thank you, James.
My pleasure.
So if McCain would have won, it would have been an interesting reaction from the Chinese, huh?
Sell! But, of course, it didn't happen. And there may be other sell triggers that the Chinese have as well, not just McCain. But
well,
it was
we'll
interesting
have James
stuff.
Come back
Absolutely.
For that perspective. It's priceless. Question for you. Does it matter where your possessions are made?
Bring manufacturing back to America. If you bring all those plants, those auto plants, back to America, unemployment would cease to exist.
So what's your thought here? Does it matter where your clothes or food or cars, for that matter, come from? Will you only buy cars here in the U.S.? Does it matter if your fruit is shipped from Peru? Are you willing to buy wine from Salt Lake City instead of France or South Africa? Tell us your take, 8778, my take or my take at thetakeaway.org. And here's a thought for you.
The humble shipping container was more important for the growth of the global economy and world trade than the microchip.
That's the BBC's Jeremy Hillman talking about a year-long project to tell the story of international trade and globalization tracking a container across the world.
We live in a shipping container world. I'm John Hockenberry.
And I'm Adora Udoji, and this is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its campaign for American workers. More at rockfound.org. This is The Takeaway.
Obama's mafia may not be in Chicago. Obama has named his Veterans Administration Chief General Eric Shinseki. They both share opposition to the invasion of Iraq and the state of Hawaii. Both grew up there. Is Hawaii the new Washington? Beats Crawford, Texas. Book 'em, Dano. It's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Monday, December 8th, and I think you just came up with that because you wanted to say that. Book 'em, Dano.
And The Ventures. I like having it on the show. Thank you. Good morning, Adora.
Good morning, everyone. We'll talk about the alleged mastermind of the 9/11 attacks because he is in court this week. A report that suggests it's okay for healthy people to take mind-enhancing drugs. And it is the anniversary of NAFTA. We have a briefing book for incoming President Barack Obama. Those stories are coming up. First, these headlines.
Congress is continuing to work on a loan package for the big three automakers. Lawmakers want accountability, so expect to see lots of strings attached. And the president-elect reportedly supports kicking out car executives if needed.
If this management team that's currently in place doesn't understand the urgency of the situation and is not willing to make the tough choices and adapt to these new circumstances, then they should go.
The latest deal would give car makers about $15 billion in immediate loans. That's a lot less than the car companies have wanted. Retired Army General Eric Shinseki is the newest nominee to the Obama cabinet as Veterans Affairs Secretary. Here's Shinseki.
I can think of no higher responsibility than ensuring that men and women who have served our nation in uniform are treated with the care and respect that they have earned.
He's done more than grow up in Hawaii, as I said at the top of the hour. As Army Chief of Staff in 2003, Shinseki told Congress it would take hundreds of thousands of American troops to stabilize post-invasion Iraq. His boss at the time was Don Rumsfeld, who was not pleased.
A dozen militants are under arrest in Pakistan on suspicion of helping the Mumbai attackers. Pakistani forces raided a camp used by the militant group Lashkar-e-Taiba. Many blame that group for the shootings, and there are reports this morning that one of the militants captured was the man India says masterminded the attacks. Widespread protests are rocking Greece. A fatal police shooting of a teen boy in Athens sparked them. Some turned violent, with rioters smashing windows and torching dozens of cars and banks. A Greek cop involved with the shooting faces a murder charge.
Gas is now at its lowest price in nearly 5 years. Regular is $1.75 a gallon by average. Dow Chemical will cut 11,000 jobs, including 5,000 of its full-time workforce. Dozens of plants reportedly will close. And Wall Street is happy about everything that's going on this morning. It's poised to open very, very positively in about 30 minutes. The S&P was up more than 3.5% to close at 876 last week, and that's where it begins today.
And we want to know, do you care where your clothes or where your food comes from? Does it matter if your food is, say, shipped from Peru or from South Africa? And are you willing to buy wine from Salt Lake City instead of France? And we've just discovered they make wine in Salt Lake City.
Most of your stuff comes from containers from around the world. Do you care where your stuff comes from? Call us at 877-8MYTAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Star Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org. And by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning. This morning, our partners at the New York Times are reporting that Pakistani authorities have arrested the operational leader of the militant group Lashkar-e-Taiba. They are the Pakistan-based militant group suspected of carrying out the Mumbai terror attacks. There are also reports emerging today there is a possible link to Pakistan's main spy service, the ISI. New York Times reporter Eric Schmidt has written a front-page article in the paper today on those links. He joins us now. Good morning. Welcome back, Eric. And what have you learned?
Well, what we've learned is that while there still is no hard evidence to tie the Pakistani spy agency, the ISI, to the Mumbai attacks directly, there is a long history of cooperation between the spy agency and Lashkar-e-Taiba. This involves funding, it involves training, involves information sharing that dates back almost 20 years.
And essentially has a lot to do with Kashmir, right?
That's right. That's been the focus, of course, of Lashkar-e-Taiba's efforts. Although what we've been learning from talking to experts both inside and outside the government is that Lashkar has been expanding its agenda, if you will, trying to raise its profile, have a more worldwide kind of profile. And that's part of the reason we believe that some of the targets here had the stamp of the Western targets, certainly Americans and Brits targeted, as well as Jews in the attacks in Mumbai.
And you really lay out a very convoluted series of relationships and essentially suggest that Lashkar has been tolerated as a sort of backdoor defense for Pakistan. But increasingly, the group's agenda has been at odds with Pakistan. So what will happen now?
Well, we'll see. As you mentioned in your introduction, there have been some arrests apparently this morning at one of the training camps that Lashkar operates in Pakistan. We'll see what happens as a result of those arrests, what happens to the operational commander of Lashkar they have reportedly picked up. But as you say, the ties here between Lashkar and ISI have been long, although the goals of the group have sometimes diverged from some of its other patrons, including Al-Qaeda. Again, this is one of these organizations that has never taken on the mantle of Al-Qaeda as some of the other groups' affiliates, such as in North Africa, but in the past have taken their funding as well. Lashkar has, again, more of a regional focus in Kashmir. Al-Qaeda has a much broader focus, so they haven't always seen eye to eye in terms of their ultimate gain.
And what do you say at this point as Condoleezza Rice, our Secretary of State, returned from visiting India and Pakistan? She said with assurances from the Pakistanis that they would be cracking down on Lashkar. How capable do you think they are of actually doing that?
Well, that's the big question here, is what the Pakistanis will do. They have a history of taking certain steps, whether it be raiding camps or arresting individuals from some of these various groups, which you've identified properly as kind of proxies in their larger struggle against India. The question is, will this be permanent? Will this have some lasting effect? It's certainly what the Americans, both Condoleezza Rice and the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Mike Mullen, had demanded when they went there. They demanded a quick and thorough investigation into the possible ties with Pakistani groups, and certainly it's what the Indian government is waiting to see.
And what are you going to be waiting to see? As you've been reporting this story, certainly we are more familiar with Al-Qaeda and less so with Lashkar, which has essentially been a more regional group. What were you surprised about?
Well, again, we were very surprised, I think, at the very professional way this campaign was, the terror attacks were carried out. And certainly it reflected a degree of extensive training, almost special operations forces type precision in the way they carried out the attack on the ground. Also, it indicated that there almost certainly the attackers had some local help once they got there, certainly in terms of briefing and preparation before they went. But we're looking for ties on the ground, as investigators are, to any local support that they might have. And, of course, if there are any accomplices still on the loose.
Okay, well, we'll be looking for your next reports. Eric Schmidt, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Eric Schmidt reports for the New York Times. He has a front-page story this morning on Lashkar-e-Taiba.
From Lashkar to another terrorist organization more familiar to people in the United States, it could be a moot court, literally, down in Guantanamo Bay this week, or it could be the judicial culmination of the entire 9/11 era. Joining us now is Jonathan Mahler, New York Times Magazine contributor, to talk about the trial that begins today against Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, said to be the mastermind behind the 9/11 attacks, and four co-defendants. It will be one of the final sessions of the war crimes tribunals under outgoing President George W. Bush. Jonathan Mahler, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
What do you make of the significance of this set of hearings this week? Certainly my friends who actually work down in Miami and who do reporting at Gitmo say just seeing Khalid Sheikh Mohammed after all these years is fabulous enough.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's in terms of the significance, I think it's both enormously significant and quite insignificant. I mean, it's certainly significant that, you know, we're finally bringing the guy who's the alleged mastermind of 9/11 to justice, and he's appearing in a courtroom, and he's appearing in a courtroom, in fact, with the parents of a couple of the victims of 9/11 who were flown down yesterday, I believe, by the Pentagon. So, you know, in terms of sort of the drama of the situation, it's going to be very high. And, you know, after all, this was the whole point of these military tribunals, these war crimes trials on Guantanamo Bay, was presumably to bring to justice the people involved with 9/11. And you know, that does finally seem to be happening. So on the one hand, it's enormously significant. On the other hand, this is probably going to be the final set of pretrial hearings and indeed probably the end of these military commissions, because my guess is that Obama's not going to want to go through with them because they've been so shrouded in controversy and their legitimacy has been really questioned sort of internationally. So Khalid Sheikh Mohammed's probably not ultimately going to be tried in this court. So as a sort of a legal proceeding, they're kind of irrelevant, or probably going to be irrelevant.
I want to talk about the next legal road for Khalid mm-hmm. Sheikh Mohammed, who, you know, is a much more widely known defendant than any of the other people in
sure.
any of these Gitmo trials. But describe who's going to be down there. You alluded to some of the 9/11 victims are going to be there. There's also going to be spectators that
yeah.
Have a lottery position there, and
yeah,
the lawyers.
Well, what the Pentagon did was a lot of the families of the victims obviously wanted to see this trial happen. So I think the Pentagon had a lottery, and they selected a few families. I know one was the family of a firefighter, you know, and a few others, and they're going to be down there, within feet of KSM and separated by a glass partition, but they're going to be right there. And, you know, this is something that also the Bush administration has done before when they first brought this first group of you know, so-called high-value detainees to Guantanamo, and the president announced that years ago in a big press conference at the White House. At that time, also, he invited in all the
right.
not all of, but a group of the families of the victims. So clearly, you know, for the sort of emotional impact
well, that's what they're going for.
I
guess, you know, what is the chance that this will be some sort of summing up for the Bush administration of, hey, we made a lot of mistakes, but at least we were right about this one? And
yeah.
what is the avenue for the Obama administration
yeah.
to make sure that Khalid Sheikh Mohammed's charges are fully examined in open court?
Yeah. Yeah, sure. Well, I mean, I think certainly from the Bush administration's perspective, that's what this is all about. I mean, that trying to, you know, as in his final weeks here, these military tribunals and of course 9/11 was, you know, was this sort of central aspect of his campaign and against terrorism. So, you know, there's no question that he's going for kind of symbolic impact here, particularly because, you know, the trial's never going to get started before he leaves office. These are just pretrial hearings, but they're really, you know, trying to expedite them and push them through so that he can make this statement now. So there's no question that there is a sort of symbolic, it's primarily symbolic for the Bush administration.
And for the Obama administration?
Well, I mean, I think the big question is whether or not KSM can be tried in federal court. And that's I think, what everyone, including the Obama administration, would prefer. But, you know, you have a guy who's the CIA has he's one of only a few guys who the CIA has admitted to torturing. They've admitted to waterboarding him. And so, you know, you're going to have big questions about the admissibility of evidence in federal court. So I think that, you know, probably what's going to happen is that I'm not sure that the Obama administration has made any decisions yet. I think once he gets into office, his sort of national security and legal team is going to take a close look at the evidence against him and try to figure out whether they can bring this case in federal court, because I'm sure they would much prefer that.
And lots of questions there about who can testify, since the CIA is all over Khalid Sheikh Mohammed. Jonathan Mahler is a New York Times Magazine contributor and author of The Challenge, Hamdan v. Rumsfeld, and The Fight Over Presidential Power.
It's such a thicket of, yeah. of colliding, massive, basic questions about our legal system and the Constitution.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
869-8253. Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, asking what is responsibility in this day and age? Everybody has their own opinion. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. This morning we're thinking about how our things travel around the world before they end up in our homes or in our cars.
I went to this great big traditional shoe store in Paramus, New Jersey, and I asked them for a pair of American-made shoes. They could only show me two pairs. So I had to pay $300 to have a pair of American-made shoes, and I hardly wear them because they hurt my feet.
Ouch.
Well, that's not necessarily a happy ending, but we appreciate your story and would like to hear all of them. Do you specifically try to buy American goods? We want to hear that story. And have you found some shoes that perhaps are comfortable? Give us a call at 8778-MY-TAKE or MyTAKE at thetakeaway.org.
Just looking for some comfortable shoes here at The Takeaway. That's the issue. But if you think the issue of performance-enhancing drugs in international sports is a gray area filled with all kinds of controversy, with a focus on contaminated urine, high-quality, comfortable sneakers, and strange super high-tech swimming suits, and all the controversies that you hear about every 4 years at the Olympics, think about neuroscience with the development of new smart pills and new brain-enhancing drugs. The question of normal is a controversy not just for athletes anymore, but now for everyone. Joining us is Martha Farah. She's director of the Center for Cognitive Neuroscience at the University of Pennsylvania. Martha, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Now, you believe in a, let me call it a manifesto, that everyone should be allowed to essentially take a pill and improve the quality of their brain, and that this notion of enhancement getting in the way of our idea about normal human beings is a bit of a romantic nicety we should put in the past. Is that a fair assessment of what you've written?
Yes, yes, it is, as long as you allow me to immediately attach a little follow-up.
You go.
That says, you know, look, the enhancing drugs we have now are somewhat effective, and they're somewhat safe. They're really not ideal drugs. So if somebody wants to use them now, they should be allowed once they are informed about,
right,
you know, what they can look to get from them and what the risks are. And we're really talking more about going forward into the future when we can expect more effective drugs.
What's coming down the pike? Well, let's make a list then. What's available now that might be appropriate for people wanting to enhance their own mental performance? And what's coming down the pipeline?
Well, what's available now that is actually being used quite widely on American college campuses is a class of drugs that was developed mainly for the treatment of ADHD, attention deficit hyperactivity disorder.
Right.
But these drugs not only improve the attention of people with ADHD, they improve almost everybody's attention. Now, again, I know it's probably exasperating for radio hosts to hear academics go into all the but then and on the other hands, but I have to immediately also say that some people actually do worse when they're on these drugs. So your listeners should not just go right out and ask their doctors for prescriptions for Ritalin and Adderall. But it is certainly the case that lots of normal, healthy people who don't have ADHD do improve their attention, their concentration, ability to resist distraction, that sort of thing, with these drugs. And a lot of healthy college students are using them now.
All right, that's now. But wait, there's more. What's coming down the pipeline?
Yes, there's more. Well, right, just trickling out of the pipeline right now is the use of a drug that will probably grow. It's a drug that was developed to treat narcolepsy and the fatigue, you know, that accompanies other kinds of sleep disorders. The drug's called modafinil. The trade name is Provigil. And what's interesting is that, again, a normal, healthy person who doesn't have a sleep disorder can stay awake and alert and functioning for actually days on end, without feeling rotten and without kind of losing it cognitively.
You've definitely got
and
the
even,
attention of my co-host, who considers
this
show
well,
as a form of sleep disorder.
No, but what are the side effects?
Journalists love this stuff. Yeah. Okay, side effects,
yes,
right.
Yes, that's what I want.
Well, you know, okay, I'm not a doctor and I don't play one on TV, but I can tell you that this drug lets you feel okay while you're sleep deprived and lets you function cognitively well while you're sleep deprived. But it doesn't spare your body the whole range of bad effects of sleep deprivation. So basically, in a way, this drug is quite dangerous because it could kind of lull you into thinking you're fine going without sleep on a regular basis, when in fact, that's really bad for you.
But trust me, I think we've come to understand that in a new way.
Exactly. How much blowback do you expect to get from the neuroscience community or health specialists, pediatricians, about your notion that we need to embrace this idea of enhancement and not, you know, consider it some sort of moral taboo?
Well, you know, the opinions we've been hearing run the gamut from, of course, let's get over our prudish, you know, pharmacological Calvinism that says you have to do everything the hard way, you know, to this is, you know, a horrible distortion of what medicine is about. Medicine is about healing. But of course, to that, I say, well, tell that to your cosmetic dermatologist and plastic surgeon friends. There are examples already where medicine has been used to enhance people's lifestyle, whatever you want to call it.
Do you use the term pharmacological Calvinism in your article that appears in Nature?
No, I don't.
You should think
about
that.
I got it from somebody. I can't remember who.
I like that. That's pretty good. Is it the case that Americans who take vitamins are basically thinking the same thought about enhancing their physical lives as someone who would take Ritalin or Adderall or Provigil or any of these other drugs you've referred to?
Well, there you go. I mean, I think that's a great analogy. I mean, I think the impulse is the same, right? We don't turn to those people and say, ah, but you should be eating 4 to 5 servings of fruits and vegetables. And, you know, I mean, yes, they should be, and they know that, but they don't always do it, and it's helpful to get a little help from a pill. So I think there's definitely an analogy there.
A little help from my friends. Controversial article, and it's in the current issue of Nature. Martha Farah, thank you. She's the director of the Center for Cognitive Neuroscience at the University of Pennsylvania. And now we have headlines from Femi Oke.
Thanks, John. The time is just coming up to 29 minutes past the hour. Gas is at its lowest price in nearly 5 years. A new national survey says that right now the average price of a regular $1.75 a gallon. Now, last week, the price of gas dropped 25%, and that's the biggest decline in a week since 1991. The Senate will take another look at a package for automakers this morning. Congressional aides say that an auto industry package may include high-level oversight and mandatory restructuring. Fugitive Taliban leader Mullah Omar is promising more violence in Afghanistan over the coming year. That's despite US plans to deploy thousands more troops to turn around the war. Afghanistan is going through its most violent period since 2001. And a group of high-powered statesmen and stateswomen is paying Zimbabwe President Robert Mugabe a visit. They want to see what can be done to counter a cholera epidemic in that country that's killed almost 600 people.
They should just kidnap him. Excuse me, that was uncalled for. But, it is outrageous what's going on in Zimbabwe. Thank you, Femi.
You're welcome.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org. And by the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs around the world. Uncommon heroes dedicated to the common good. Learn more at skoll.org.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual Insurance, offering home, auto, and life insurance products to individuals and families who put a premium on doing the right thing. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
NAFTA will tear down trade barriers between our three nations. It will create the world's largest trade zone and create 200,000 jobs in this country by 1995 alone.
That was President Bill Clinton 15 years ago today after signing the North American Free Trade Agreement into law. It's actually taken all of these years for it to be fully implemented, and now it's soon to be an issue on the desk of incoming President Barack Obama. Joining us now to add a few pages to America's briefing book for the new president is Edward Alden, senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations and an expert on U.S. trade policy. Welcome, Edward.
Good morning, Eudora. Thank you for having me on the show.
So has NAFTA been a success or failure?
It's probably been a wash. If you look at expert opinion on it, there have been gains in terms of overall American productivity. There have been gains in terms of lower consumer prices. There have probably been slight gains in terms of overall economic growth. But there have been a lot of losers as well in both the United States and Mexico. So the general consensus at this point is ambivalent. Some gains, some losses, modest overall either way.
Let's take a listen to Barack Obama on August 7th, suggesting that perhaps it was more bad than good.
I would immediately call the president of Mexico, the president of Canada, to try to amend NAFTA, because I think that we can get labor agreements in that agreement right now.
So that was during the campaign. Now it's about governing. Where do you think Obama is on this, or where do you think he should be?
Well, I think he continues to be divided. I mean, his first appointment in this regard, Bill Richardson, was a staunch supporter of NAFTA. In fact, was President Clinton's, one of President Clinton's closest allies in the Congress in trying to push the deal through. Barack Obama is likely to appoint a U.S. trade representative, Javier Becerra, who's much more of a trade skeptic. I think this is an issue that divides the Democrats, and I think it's an issue on which his administration will be internally divided.
Can you lay out some of the specifics here? He was talking in that soundbite that we just played about labor agreements. Is that the central concern, or are there others?
I think the concerns are much broader. I think, the general feeling in the Democratic Party is that the benefits that have come from NAFTA and other trade agreements have not been widely shared in the United States. So the big concern is the stagnation of middle-class wages and the feeling that competition has tended to keep those wages lower than they might otherwise have been. And so the reason we see this focus on labor standards is the hope that by bringing up labor standards in Mexico and China and other countries, you'll relieve some of that competitive pressure on U.S. manufacturing workers in particular. But it's a pretty roundabout way to get at the problem. I think there's general agreement now that we need to look at issues like education, at worker retraining, at health care, at more progressive taxation policies, at policies that more directly target the fact that the benefits from trade deals have not been evenly spread.
Given the economic environment, what would you advise if you were sitting down to talk to President-elect Obama?
Well, one of the things that was talked about during the primary that I think makes sense is some kind of timeout in terms of negotiating further trade agreements. For the past 20 years, the United States has entered into a series of agreements bilateral and internationally through the World Trade Organization that I think made a lot of sense. They've expanded trade dramatically. They've helped raise living standards in much of the world. But I think we're at a point now with the current recession where we need to think very strategically about what we want to do next. So I'd say that this is actually one of those issues where it makes sense to put together an independent commission and think about the issue some. Secondarily,
argue that— Oh, no, not another commission.
Well, in this case, I think there isn't consensus in the party or in the country on where to go on trade. So I actually think this is an issue on which we do need some fresh thought. But the other thing I would say in the interim is don't put in place measures that undo the gains that have been made. I mean, there's talk in the Democratic Party, for instance, about slapping tariffs on Chinese imports. That would be an incredibly provocative move that would provoke a Chinese counterreaction. And it's easy to imagine in the current economic environment doing things that make the world economy not stronger but weaker. And so I would counsel him to resist those tendencies.
Well, back in this hemisphere on the NAFTA issue, Edward Alden, you've been to the blogosphere. You probably know what I'm talking about here. Can you give us a preview of what the Amero is going to look like when they finally get around to mixing the dollar, the Canadian dollar, and the peso together and come up with this Amero currency?
Well, I think the Amero died a long time ago. I mean, there were
millions of hits on the internet about when the Amero is going to happen.
Oh, I know. And add in Council on Foreign Relations, and we're apparently the primary advocates of the Amero.
Yes.
There were, you know, I think if you go back into the 90s, there were people in Canada, some in the United States, to a lesser extent in Mexico, who thought that it made sense for North America to go down the European Union road, so to keep moving towards closer and closer integration. But really, that whole set of ideas never got off the ground, and there's no popular support for it, not just in the United States. There's no support in Canada or in Mexico. And so the likelihood of any sort of closer integration, much less imagining a common North American currency, I think is if it ever happens, it's very, very distant in the future. It's certainly not on the table right now.
Hey, Edward, do you know where your clothes or where your food, the food that you buy, do you know where it comes from?
Yeah, I pay a lot of attention to this, actually, because I've covered these things very closely. Every time I buy a piece of clothing, I look at the label, and I can probably tell you the particular trade program under which it was manufactured. Same for food.
So. Do you have any particular favorites, perhaps?
Well, I like suits from Canada. There are actually a lot of, I mean, it's okay. One of the few parts of the clothing industry that continues to survive in North America as a result of a special preference program set up under NAFTA.
Edward,
there are a lot of wool suits made in Montreal, and the one I'm wearing this morning is one of those.
So forget Savile Row in London.
Right. Nah, I can't afford that.
Ted Olden is a senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations and an expert on U.S. trade policy, and I prefer my suits from Canada, I think is a worthy
Canada
way of talking
suits,
about it.
Suits Canada wouldn't be necessarily the first place.
Where does your stuff come from? That's what we're talking about this hour, 877-8-MY-TAKE or MYTAKE at thetakeaway.org. And now Femi has some headlines.
Thank you. The time is 20 minutes to the top of the hour. World markets are soaring this morning. Just a few moments ago, the Dow was up 222 points. Asian indices closed up. European markets have been climbing. And let's take a look at some oil prices for you as well. They bounced back to more than $44 a barrel. And this after a statement by OPEC's president. He suggested the group could cut production later this month. New efforts are underway to arrange peace talks between the Afghan government and the Taliban. The BBC Kabul correspondent says that a meeting is being planned in Dubai in the coming days between representatives of the Taliban and the Afghan government. Washington is also understood to be backing these talks. And votes are being counted in Ghana today. Yesterday, Ghanaians went to the polls for parliamentary and presidential elections. Turnout was very high and voters are enthusiastically following the parliamentary results as they come in.
We are celebrating because our parliamentary candidate for NDC, Fotu Klote, has won the seat of the government.
Now, you don't need to know exactly what she said, but she is very excited that her candidate actually won. The presidential election is expected to be very close indeed. And that's a look at some of your news from around the world this morning.
Thank you, Femi.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
Good morning. This is The Takeaway. I'm Adora Udoji.
And I'm John Hockenberry. You know, I had a massive flashback last Friday. The Labor Department announced the unemployment rate for November, 533,000 people out of work, and it contained the statistic that the U.S. economy lost more jobs than at any time in 34 years, since 1974, as if I needed another reason to remember that dog of a year when I graduated from high school.
I shall resign the presidency effective at noon tomorrow.
Get down, get down, get down, get down.
Sunshine on my shoulders.
Even if the music hadn't been dreadful, 1974 was the worst year. There's kidnapped Patty Hearst, giving revolutionaries a bad name right there. President Nixon resigned. Gerry Ford, my boring congressman, became president. A recession took hold, and I had to get a job in auto industry Ground Zero, Michigan. It was a terrible time for someone just starting out. Job one, factory tool shop. Got my layoff notice about a month later. Job two, driving a truck for a lumber yard until the yard just stopped its delivery service. Couldn't afford it. Joblessness was breaking all records.
Swinging. There's a drive into left center field. That ball is going to be out of here. It
All right, Hank Aaron had a good year anyway, breaking Babe Ruth's home run record. But as I tried to save money to put myself through college, it became clear the recession was deepening. Job 3, welder. Until I fell asleep and got fired because job 4, I was working nights as a dishwasher. Yeah, 1974 was just awful. Even the escapist entertainment sucked.
Steve McQueen and Paul Newman race against time as one tiny spark becomes a night of blazing suspense. The Towering Inferno.
Everybody was kung fu fighting.
I mean, let's be real. I was lucky. I had no family to support, no bills other than college tuition to pay. After the restaurant, job 5, car wash. Job 6, I worked at a nursing home. Job 7, ouch, playing guitar in a coffee house. Me and way more than a half million other workers bouncing from job to job.
If I leave here tomorrow, would you still remember me?
All right, this was a decent 1974 song, but then much of the Lynyrd Skynyrd band died in a plane crash 3 years later.
When will I see you again?
You know, and I always thought that song was a total ripoff of Freebird. Basically, though, when I graduated from high school, I had all kinds of specific ideas about wanting to be a mathematician or an actor or even an anthropologist, go figure. But by the end of the year of layoffs and door slams, I was ready to go live in the woods. I barely had the money to go to college, and I had no idea what I wanted to do there.
There's got to be a morning after.
Well, 1974 did come to an end, of course. My last job that year was delivering newspapers. And in the end, this recession-induced uncertainty led me onto a path I never considered: journalism. Silver lining? I don't know about that. Hey, don't thank me for the recession. But you can thank a recession for having to listen to me in the morning.
Can't you see the morning after? It's waiting right outside the store.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, featuring stories of responsible acts that happen every day. Stories to read, share, and respond to, available at responsibilityproject.com. Because one responsible act can make an unforgettable difference.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. It's Monday, December 8th. Femi Oke is here. And what's happening today?
Hello there, Adora. 12 minutes to the top of the hour. Well, it's not a done deal yet, but it looks like automakers will get something of a bailout, although much less money than they wanted. Lawmakers are working on final details right now, but it appears the big three will get loans adding up to around about $15 billion. Retired Army General Eric Shinseki is the latest nominee to the Obama cabinet. The president-elect tapped the former Army Chief of Staff as his Veterans Affairs Secretary. Shinseki drew criticism from the Bush administration in 2003 after he publicly contradicted Don Rumsfeld's plan for a lean American troop presence. European Union troops start hunting for pirates today. An EU naval mission will be in waters near Somalia, and there have been dozens of pirate attacks in that area. And recently, pirates have gotten stronger and bolder, using more powerful weapons to hijack larger ships. And finally, Gilbert Kaplan will be conducting the New York Philharmonic Orchestra tonight. In the 1980s, he gave up his publishing job to take up conducting just one symphony, Gustav Mahler's Second Symphony. Tonight will be historic. It's the 100 years since Mahler himself conducted the Resurrection Symphony.
I'm counting on Monday night being something rather special because, as Mahler said himself, there's no way to escape the power of this music. And I think it all depends on the mood of the night, what happens. You feel the tempo just stretching somewhere, so you go with it. You didn't intend to. And then maybe magic happens.
Nice.
Thank you. And good night, ladies and gentlemen.
Great. So, story just breaking the wires. The AP says five 9/11 defendants at Guantanamo Bay have asked the judge for Sessions to announce a confession. We'll find out more about that tomorrow, but the Khalid Sheikh Mohammed trial is going on down at Gitmo. Those details may be an indication of things to come. We're looking at how stuff travels around the world before coming to our home. You tell us at 877-8MYTAKE or MyTAKE at thetakeaway.org.
And now we're going to talk about President-elect Barack Obama in a little different way than usual. Clearly, he's got a lot on his plate with a crumbling economy, two wars that the U.S. is currently involved in, but he also has something else on his mind.
We want to talk about parents reading to their kids, thinking about the diversity of our culture, and inviting jazz musicians and classical musicians and poetry readings in the White House so that once again we appreciate this incredible tapestry that's America.
That was the president-elect on Meet the Press yesterday talking about the cultural effect that he hopes he and his wife Michelle Obama will have in the White House. We're going to investigate this idea further with Takeaway contributor and Essence Magazine senior editor Patrick Henry Bass. He joins us in the studio.
Good morning. Good to see both of you.
So on the agenda for President-elect Obama is the media, the arts, culture. And let's start with him and what he's done for the media business in, let's say, the last 2 years.
He's been a gift, at least in this last quarter. Anyone who saw the headlines coming out of the major publishers, it was shocking that Doubleday, you know, the venerable house that produced Roots and Jaws, is no longer. I mean, Doubleday is now an imprint of Knopf. You know, Simon & Schuster laid off over 100 workers, and Houghton Mifflin, the publisher of Gunter Grass, are no longer doing acquisitions. They've frozen their acquisitions. So these are dark, dark times in publishing. Ironically enough, the books that are moving are not Stephen King or Toni Morrison, but Obama books. Anything Obama is moving, you know, like gangbusters, not just in bookstores, but also on newsstands, which is good news for Time Magazine and People Magazine and also us at Essence Magazine.
And after the election, speaking to that, everyone jumped on the bandwagon, right, including newspapers, because they were sold out immediately with him on the front page.
Exactly. You can now get the New York Times November 4th, 2008 cover on eBay. It's going up to $500, you know.
I mean, I wonder if New York Times sales of the Obama Election Day issue is subsidizing the sales of today's paper, for instance.
Yeah, well, one would hope so. I mean, what people are now trying to focus on is the inauguration, because like they really feel like that's where the money is to be made. There's a book called Yes, We Can from a photographer who followed the Obama campaign for 2 years that Powerhouse threw out last week. It's already sold 60,000 copies. You know, 60,000
wow.
copies in this economy. Time Magazine produced a bookazine called The Path to Power. It quickly sold out. They rushed it into hardcover. Now they're about to do a hardcover edition with expanded inauguration coverage.
You know, there's an irony here because the media, particularly the television networks, are suffering from the lack of Obama campaign advertising money as part of their revenue, but they can book him for the Sunday talk shows, for instance, and get some of those ratings back.
Right, and also MSNBC is now selling an Obama DVD. You know, just the best of MSNBC's
coverage. How long can this continue? And is it just really a blimp on the screen of industries that are really troubled, facing challenges by the internet and the terrible economy that we're suffering?
Right. Well, people are, you know, responding to the optimism and hope of the Obamas in their story. That's what the Essence book is called. We're doing a bookazine coming in January called The Obamas, you know, America's New First Family.
Wait, so you've got a conflict of interest.
I know, right? Thanks for just being open and candid with us.
Well, I have full disclosure, but the big news will be the moment that he puts his hand in that Bible and takes the oath, all bets are off. You know, Wynton Marsalis and Rita Dove will come to the White House and they will read and Wynton will jazz it up. But the gloves are off in terms of media. The gloves are off in terms of, you know, the public, because he's going to start making decisions that are going to be unpopular with people. And you're going to start to see a wave of anti-Obama books in the fall, especially from Regnery and some of the folks at Fox News and some of the conservative columnists, and not just the conservative columnists. Jabari Yassim, who is the editor-in-chief of Crisis Magazine, has a very critical book on Obama coming in January.
Well, but the Kennedy buzz for media continued well after the inauguration. I mean, Life magazine was kept afloat, basically, yeah, by pictures of Kennedy
Absolutely.
Kids in the White House. So I guess, you know, until the Bay of Pigs, the Obama Bay of Pigs were in pretty good shape.
Oh, let's not hope there is one. Let's not predict that on our show, of all places. But just to get to your point about who will be invited to the White House, this notion of encouraging Americans to embrace the culture that exists and stitches, you know, part of our fabric, Isn't that a change? I mean, the White House hasn't sort of been leading the
Smart is back,
march.
Right? Smart is back, and Smart is in again, thank God. And we have a clear difference between our current president and our president-elect, and that our current president said he doesn't read newspapers at all, whereas our president-elect is very literate, you know, wrote his own book, you know, Dreams for My Father, loves literature, loves science, loves innovation, loves ideas. So expect to see, you know, a lot of those Knopf authors, you know, a lot of poets, a lot of, you know, actors, a lot of musicians back at the White House.
But doesn't it give those industries then a bump and exposure that they wouldn't necessarily have if Obama was not in the White House?
Exactly. What many people want to then see, if Barack and Michelle Obama are serious about the arts, and people want to see more funding for the National Endowment for the Arts, they will want to see more legislation on the Hill about the arts, you know, returning funding to schools. If they're serious about, you know, bringing the arts into public schools, then people want to see legislation that would back that up.
An arts stimulus package. I don't know. That may be a low percentage shot.
But I think there's a good argument that if it's mentioned as something that was important, because what was fascinating about this interview that Tom Brokaw did on Meet the Press is he asked him, have you and Michelle Obama thought about the cultures and how that's going to affect what you do in the White House, and he came out with his answer.
Yeah, he did.
He said they have talked about it.
John, but back to, you know, the Kennedy administration, Bunny Mellon and Jane Wrightsman were these, you know, consultants for Jackie O, and she used to do all of these wonderful, sure, you know, speaking, you know, yeah, lectures, and I think that Michelle Obama is definitely modeling herself on Jackie O in that way.
And it goes back a long way. I mean, Teddy Roosevelt had an enormous influence on the culture. The Natural History Museum is a result of him. The whole environmental conservationist movement was created from Teddy Roosevelt's sort of influence on the culture.
Exactly, and publishers are keeping their fingers crossed that this will translate into sales, and that Obama can possibly be the next O. He could be an Oprah in terms of endorsing an author or liking
the
an
next
author.
Or the next
That's
Teddy
it.
Roosevelt,
there
who
you
is
go.
A successful author, or General Grant, who still
you
has
learned
the
it
best
on the takeaway.
Memoir.
It
was this
the
is an
next
exclusive.
O.
But remember, Bill Clinton helped out the sales of Walter Mosley tremendously. Walter Mosley just sort of been, you know,
the author.
Well, no one really knew who he was. I mean, he had a small fan base, and then Bill Clinton in an interview said that Walter Mosley was his favorite author, and Walter Mosley's career took off after that.
Thanks so much for joining us, Patrick Henry Bass, Takeaway contributor and senior editor with Essence Magazine, and he had Smart is Back. He's had The Next O.
Everyone wants to be Barack Obama's favorite author, that's for sure. But here's a question. Does it matter where your stuff comes from?
I'm like every other American. I want to buy cheap, so it has to come from China and Indonesia and all those far-out places, and I want to earn a lot of money. $7.15 an hour is not enough. That's why we love Walmart and Costco and all those cheap places.
We're looking at our container planet. Tell us your take about where things come from and whether you prefer to buy local or are happy with the way things are. 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. And here's your takeaway.
It is certainly the case that lots of normal, healthy people who don't have ADHD do improve their attention, their concentration, ability to resist distraction, that sort of thing, with these drugs.
Drugs coming down the pike that improve your brain. Disclaimer, not for everyone. That's University of Pennsylvania's Martha Farah talking about the drugs people can take to sharpen their minds. I'm John Huckenberry.
I'm Adora Udoji, and this is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its Campaign for American Workers. More at rockfound.org. This is The Takeaway.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, the New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.